Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Legacy Finance Committee meeting to order. And we have a quorum, so we're ready to be open for business. Representative Scraba, you have an opportunity to peek at the minutes, and if so, would you be willing to move the February 14th minutes?
So moved, Chair.
Thank you. Any questions in regards to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Thank you, Representative Scraba. We have the minutes approved. So we've been kind of moving through the funds. We had Lasard Sams and folks come in the first meeting, and again, nice to see them in the crowd. So if you ever have questions regards to them, we're going to have the bill. Was it introduced? Was it turned in? Okay, good. So it's turned in if you want to sign on to the Lasard Sams bill, but it's in the hopper and moving along. And but again, Mr. Johnson and his team are available for questions if you have any in regards to those funds, and we'll have the bill back, you know, through the committee later. And so today we're shifting and moving on to the clean water portion of the funds, and we're lucky enough to have the chair with us today, and Mr. Gardner. And Mr. Gardner had kind of a funny comment. He said he speaks what do you call it? Legislative ease or something? Yeah.
The agencies like me as a translator of what you say, and you'll enjoy my translation of what they say. So.
Okay. So being a former representative. So welcome to the committee, and I hope members are willing to ask questions, and don't be shy if you have something that you want to address. And you know, we're lucky to have quite a bit of talent here at the tables as well. So, Mr. Barton, if you'd be willing to kick us off and introduce yourself, tell us about where you're at in the cycle, and then I think today we'd like to hear what you've done, you know, with last year's, you know, the big bonding, you know, with the big appropriation, and then moving forward, what our plans are. But, and I know that'll be part of your presentation, but. Mr. Barton, welcome. Thank you for the work you do, sir.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Barton. I currently chair the Clean Water Council, and I represent Lakes and Streams nonprofit organizations on that council. And I'm just going to give a real brief introduction, primarily focusing on our supplemental budget recommendations, and Paul's going to go over some of the details of those recommendations as well as some of the progress that we've made utilizing the clean water funds over the past couple of years. Excuse me. So first of all, thank you for considering our recommendations for the supplemental clean water appropriation funds. The Clean Water Council in its deliberations on the fund looked at the nitrate issues in southeast Minnesota as a major public health emergency. So our priority in our recommendations for the use or allocation of those funds was focused on those nitrate concerns. And as a result, a significant portion of our recommendations are to allocate funds to address those nitrate issues. The council views this as a short-term stopgap funding measure, recognizing that it is, as I indicated, a public health emergency because there are a lot of folks down there that are drinking water that is unsafe for human consumption with high nitrate levels, and we viewed that as a major concern. So a lot of the recommendations are allocated to addressing that problem. But we do recognize that in the long term, some additional funding sources will be needed to address not only the nitrogen problems in southeast Minnesota, but also through the central sand areas throughout the rest of Minnesota, because we have nitrate problems in many places, and the Clean Water Fund is simply not adequate to address all of those concerns. The council spent a considerable amount of time addressing the issue of utilizing the Clean Water Fund to mitigate private wells in southeast Minnesota. The data, however, has shown that many of those highly contaminated wells were constructed pre-adoption of the state well code, and therefore they're non-conforming wells or possibly substandard wells. And as a result, some of those wells act as a conduit allowing nitrogen from the land surface to go directly into the groundwater aquifers. So that is obviously a water quality problem that the fund is set up to address. And so you'll notice in the recommendations that a portion of the funds are going to address that problem. However, the council also recognizes that a major part of the problem is fertilizer or nitrogen leaching into the groundwater from agricultural uses, either fertilizer or manure. And there is a recommendation also in your packet that is to accelerate the addressing of those issues. That's been going on for quite a while, but this is a request to provide some additional funding to accelerate the use of those or to accelerate addressing those concerns. So with that, that's kind of the main focus of the Clean Water Council's discussions relative to the appropriation of these supplemental funds. And Paul's going to go over in detail on some of that with some slides to give you a better idea of what other priorities we hope to address with these supplemental funding. So,
Mr. Barton, can you just back up for a second, too, and just kind of tell us more about the council and how many meetings you typically have during the year and who the members are and that sort of thing?
Oh, sure. The council is composed of 17 voting members, and they represent disparate groups across the state. As I mentioned, I represent Lakes and Streams Nonprofit. We have environmental groups that are represented. We have business communities. We have city government, county government, both urban and rural, represented on council. We have folks from all across the state, so not just in the metro area, obviously, but from greater Minnesota as well as from the metro. So if, for county government, as example, we have one representative from Metro County and another county representative from greater Minnesota. And the same thing is true of this municipal representative. So we have the 17 voting members. We also have four legislative members, two from each party and two from each branch of the legislature. In addition, we have regular attendance from almost all of the state agencies. We meet generally, the full council meets once monthly. We also have a budget and outcomes committee that meets monthly to discuss primarily budget issues, and we have a policy committee that meets monthly. So in essence, we have three meetings per month. Not all of the members are at each meeting, but the members are split between the budget committee as well as the policy committee.
Thank you. That's okay. That's good for now. Great. Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment for those of the committee that might have heard that there's a number of legislators appointed to serve on the Clean Water Council. Don't get stars in your eyes. You are a non-voting member. So you may think you have say like you would on, say, for example, the LCCMR. You do have an opportunity, of course, to observe and participate in conversation, but that's the extent of it for the most part. And the public should probably be aware of that as well, that the Clean Water Council acts on its own, although I do believe there's a number of others from, and the director and the chair could correct me, but a number of others from agencies that may have a vote, if I am correct, but that might not be. So that's clarified. No, just the appointed members of the committee have a vote on the decisions or the appropriations, the recommendations.
Thank you, Representative Heitzman, just so that I think it's good for members of the of this committee to know the differences between this and some other committees that members might serve on, and so that is real. Mr. Gardner, welcome back to the legislature, and welcome to Legacy. Thank you for your work that you do, and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I am the administrator for the Clean Water Council. Thank you very much again for giving us a generous amount of time, Mr. Chair. I know with all the bill hearings going on, people usually get 2 or 3 minutes, and in this case, I think you want to have a deeper dive into how we're using the fund and what kind of outcomes we're getting. Just to follow up on Representative Heinzman's comments, we do have 17 voting members and 11 non-voting members. The non-voting members are with our state agencies, the University of Minnesota, and four legislators, one from each caucus, from each house. So we have Senator Mitchell, Senator Wiesenberg, Representative Heintzman, and Representative Purcell. Representative Purcell actually has a lot of experience in the agricultural water quality space, too, so it's been good. I know what it was like as a legislator to be on something where I couldn't vote, and I can appreciate the things, but we can say is that we do listen to the people who do appropriate the money, whether they can vote or not. Mr. Chair, I wanted to cover a couple things. You had asked for something, but we also have a supplemental appropriation request for the Clean Water Fund. There's $18.056 million extra for the November forecast. And the Clean Water Fund, obviously the February forecast is the number that you will look at. So we do have some recommendations for that. We are advisory and you appropriate the money, so we'll offer some advice for that. You have also asked us about agricultural water quality and what our role in that is and how that's going since the nitrate issue has popped up. And I know Chair Vang is going to have a hearing on nitrates this week, and the Senate's going to have a joint Environment Ag hearing on that topic as well. And then we also have some new outcome data that's been published. There are two big reports that come out every 2 years that have some highlights that mostly good news, but some bad news, and we just like to share where we're going. So does that work for you?
Yep.
And I know you'll just, you'll give me the hook whenever you need to or if people have questions. So we'll get right into it, Mr. Chair. So some months ago, several community and environmental groups filed a petition with the United States EPA asking for a public health emergency to be declared. That phrase is a particular legal meeting. And as part of that, the EPA met with those stakeholders as well as state agencies to see what response there would be for nitrates in public drinking water wells in southeastern Minnesota in eight counties. The karst geology there is very porous, and so contaminants on the surface can make their way relatively quickly to private wells, and we have elevated nitrate in a lot of private wells in that part of the state. That can have, particularly for infants, that is not a particularly healthy thing. The state has been asked, three agencies by the EPA, to respond to this concern with a multifaceted response and a work plan, which has been submitted. And state agencies are asking for part of that response to be funded by the Clean Water Fund in areas that we're already funding and one area that we're not, that has been a source of some controversy. And I thought we could just get right into that and see what questions emerge. So of the $18 million that we're asking for from the surplus, we would like to see $6.354 million for the public health response by the Department of Health to address nitrate in private wells in eight counties in southeastern Minnesota. We did fund with a previous appropriation, Mr. Chair, a pilot program with Olmsted County operating something called the Tap-In Collaborative. It's really a public health effort to get people to test for nitrate in their wells to see if there is a problem and then to help people figure out what to do. And in a few limited cases, we provided for people who qualified on low-income grounds for some sort of mitigation like a water treatment system. We also have a fiscal 24-25 appropriation that continues that, that will now be concentrated just in southeastern Minnesota. The EPA has asked for four things. One is to identify wells that do have elevated nitrate. We don't know where they all are because not everybody has tested. Educate those well users on what's in the well, report the results, and then to help mitigate that problem with alternative water. There are really two approaches to this that we're currently focused on. EPA suggested four. We're just focusing on two. One would be drilling new wells that, as Chair Barton referred to, is pre-code wells. Before there was a well code in the mid-70s, I'm sure in southeastern Minnesota there are probably still some hand-dug wells that existed before the well code. Pre-code wells and wells that are out of code are also more susceptible to nitrate contamination than a well-functioning well. Those wells can also be conduits for contaminants from the surface into the groundwater. The chatter online as this work plan was being put together is that some people felt that using the Clean Water Fund for mitigation to resolve that which is polluted would not be consistent with the legacy amendment. The legacy amendment, when it comes to this issue, says that we need to protect groundwater from degradation and to protect drinking water sources. I had a very thoughtful meeting with the Senate. We proactively met with them and any nonpartisan staff who would listen to see if they had any thoughts on this. And we appreciate their thoughtfulness in there. We disagree a little bit here on the hydrologic interpretation as opposed to the legal one. Most of the money that would go for mitigation, which is about $3.9 million, would go to drilling new wells, about three quarters of it. Drilling a new well protects groundwater when you're talking about old wells that are pre-code or out of code. Mr. Chair, you may remember in 2007, in former Representative Druskowski district, we had a special session to address massive flooding that took place from rainfall. It was something like 15 inches in a matter of a day. And part of the money was spent to help address contaminated wells because all this flood water was going over the well cap in a lot of wells and going into the aquifer. So I just use that example to illustrate why protecting or having up-to-code wells is so important and protects the groundwater. So we believe that drilling a new well in these selected cases is consistent with the Constitution because it does prevent degradation of groundwater. We're a little fuzzier on the reverse osmosis part, but it happens to cost 90% less than drilling a new well. In the end, Mr. Chair, we are not constitutional law experts. We welcome other interpretations of what we are recommending, but we are advisory, and we are putting that idea on the table that we could meet the needs of people who need drinking water right now. However, and if you do have adverse advice that suggests something else, we certainly can suggest where else to use the money. I have heard also that there are suggestions for alternative funding sources. That isn't really for the Clean Water Council to suggest since they're outside our remit of the Clean Water Fund. So we've put that on the table for members, and if folks want to discuss that, we certainly could.
I think it's a good time. We do have a member question, and I believe it's related to this. So, Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and to Mr. Gardner, have the MPCA Council weigh in on this, on the constitutionality issue?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, Chair Lee, so as the Clean Water Council, we're not strictly an agency, and we did have members suggest that we get a legal opinion from the Attorney General's office, and we didn't have the standing to do that. We have inquired of different agencies, and including the Department of Ag and Health, and they probably could make the constitutional argument better than we could, and if you wanted to hear from them, you certainly could. I don't have lawyers at my disposal in our advisory council role, but we could certainly have people answer the question.
Yes. Chair Lee.
So, Mr. Chair, I think I see some folks here from the Department of Health. I don't know if they have any counsel here, if they could weigh in on this since that was brought forth. Did they provide an official opinion on whether this is constitutional or not?
Okay. Someone available from the Department of Health? Thank you.
We thought we'd just jump right into it, Mr. Chair, not leave it to the end.
That's good. That's why we're here today. Welcome. I don't know if you heard the question, and I'm sure you're fully aware of the issue. But go ahead. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Council, I'm Myra Kunis. I'm the Interim Assistant Commissioner over Health Protection, so the division that will be doing this work. Chair, you can repeat the question just to make sure I have it right.
Chair Lee.
So Director Garner mentioned that you may be able to talk about the constitutionality of this, and so just wanted to see, do the Department of Health have an official position on this, the constitutionality?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair, Council, we have not had our legal representation here with us today. However, we have had them look at it and advise us on former rulings and funding that has occurred with this fund, and it has reverse osmosis has been funded before through this fund. Paul described that previously. Department of Agriculture has been funded for this before with the township pilots, and we feel that it is constitutional. It is this body's responsibility to review that as well.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then maybe to the Department of Health, can I request to have that in writing, please? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And so if you could, that'd be great, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you. I will certainly take that back to my team. Appreciate
Thank you. Before you get going, I just want to introduce, we have Representative Ellison in the crowd here, and it looks like she has a team with her. I don't know if you want to introduce them, but this is the Legacy Committee, and a few years ago, the voters of Minnesota approved a sales tax increase, and we kind of decide how to spend those funds. Today, we're talking about the clean water issue, which is obviously very important to Minnesotans all over the state. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I have with me interns from Eden Prairie and Edina that are joining just to watch the legislative process. So thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Gardner.
Maybe I could close up this one topic with two comments. One is that there is an issue of fairness that has been injected into this conversation that has a political element that isn't really within the council's remit, but I just wanted to acknowledge it. There are those who would say we're asking taxpayers to pay the bill to address a contamination issue in a well that they did not cause, and the Clean Water Act is such that agriculture isn't affected. So there are some who would say the cost should be borne by the ag producers that are using nitrogen fertilizer and manure. That I'm sure, no doubt, will be something that will be discussed in the legislature, but that isn't something that's within our bit. But I think that that's the scale of what is required here is far beyond what we could afford in the long term for the Clean Water Fund. This is a one-time request, and you have it in writing to hold against me later, that an alternative source of funding would have to be found, because the total outlay that would be required just in southeastern Minnesota is estimated at around $60 million. If the Central Sands and other parts of the state that have vulnerable aquifers for nitrate were involved, I'm just guessing with dead reckoning that could be $100 million or more. These are things that are not usually bondable. They're not involved like a 3M settlement, which is a whole another kettle of fish. There are just a lot of gaps when it comes to private wells, and I would look forward to a robust discussion at the legislature on what our path forward would be. Mr. Chair, I can go on with some of the other topics because we've got other water issues in the state. There are some other things that we're requesting for the response in southeastern Minnesota. One is to provide additional funding to existing programs to work directly with farmers to reduce nitrate in groundwater. That includes everything from field days, working with irrigators who add nitrogen to what they're spraying out from those big rigs. Showing people how they can do different types of nitrogen application, vegetated cover like you see on the right. We're also asking for some additional money for the Agricultural Best Management Practices Loan Program at the Department of Ag. Our farm members on the council indicated that the hardest thing for them to be able to switch to something that reduces the application of fertilizer is equipment. So if you're doing something like no-till farming, you need some way to get your seed into the soil, and so you use something like a no-till drill. And so they can get 3% loan or less through this program. Next, we are suggesting using $2 million in working lands and floodplain easements. These are distributed through Bowser, and they would like to be able to target that in southeastern Minnesota to take some lands out of production to help avoid the entrance of nitrate into groundwater. PFAS is also a critical issue that I'm sure everyone is familiar with. We have a wide-ranging PFAS blueprint in Minnesota put out by several agencies. We have a particular lane in the PFAS area, Mr. Chair, where we're asking for a little bit more here, including being able to look for PFAS in our regular river and lake monitoring system, looking for PFAS in fish. We currently look for PCBs and mercury, and we'd like to add PFAS, and DNR needed a little bit extra to do that. And the Department of Health has a lab where they want to determine health-based guidance for fish consumption on PFAS compounds. So for roughly $800,000, that would round out our needs for addressing the PFAS issue. We have a couple other supplemental requests. We have a backlog of requests for easements in the Rum River watershed. Not only helps protect a very healthy river generally that drains from Mille Lacs, but it also has the benefit of protecting the water that ends up flowing through the intakes for the Minneapolis and St. Paul water supply. So there's a twofer. We also know that we, for scaling up another $1 million for our septic system program at the PCA, we make grants to low-income households to be able to replace septic systems when they can't afford it themselves, and there's an imminent threat to public health. So we know that we can replace about 70 different systems for that. We've also had a new grant program that's currently in place that provides assistance to selected nonprofits and tribal governments. As far as I know, that's, well, I shouldn't say that. We've done work with tribes through some of our existing work, but I don't know that we've made grants directly with an appropriation to tribes. So we've had three grants to those right now. We've also had four NGO projects with nonprofits doing things outside of our regular planning process, from Northeast Minneapolis to Upper Red Lake, Stearns County, and the Northfield area. We also have been leaving some money on the table, Mr. Chair. You were asking me about federal money. There's federal money in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative that we have been leaving on the table because we haven't had the capacity at the local level in the Lake Superior Basin with Soil and Water Conservation Districts to apply for the money and to really do the planning to assemble projects. We do get some of that money now for the St. Louis River cleanup in the Duluth Harbor. This is a different program that focuses on land practices, everything from stormwater retrofits in small towns that are on the lakeshore to stream restorations, all for the idea of improving water in Lake Superior. But we've had to leave that money on the table because we didn't have the capacity to match, so we'd like to ask for $1 million to help kickstart that.
So, Mr. Gardner, to that point, Chair Lee has shown great leadership on trying to get information on the federal dollars, and I think you had one meeting already and then planning another one as well, I think. But it seems like there was quite a bit of money for clean water in the federal three efforts, and it's huge numbers, and it just seems like there's just natural synergy to what we're doing here. And through bonding and through, you know, just it'd be a shame to miss some of these opportunities. So are you working with the governor and his team and the feds trying to figure out what money we can get access to?
Mr. Chair,
there's also environmental race work, which is overlaps maybe with Lessard and you, and then certainly they said clean water, so it would just...
Mr. Chair, we hate to leave federal money on the table. We're also very grateful to Chair Lee and his committee and in the Senate for generous capital investment, and there has been bipartisan commitment to wastewater treatment and drinking water assistance over many decades compared to other states. So what we've been able to do to reduce phosphorus, for example, has just been outstanding. There's one particular program that we focus on that Chair Lee will recognize that I'll mention in a minute with SEGRAF, but we are looking at non-point source pollution opportunities. So there are numerous federal dollars from the Farm Bill, which make their way to Minnesota, where we can be the state match to be able to access that. There's probably a dozen different programs, Mr. Chair, that we're tapping into, and the council is certainly always on the lookout for opportunities to leverage. It's one of our key criteria for getting more stuff. I would say that the Infrastructure Bill and the Inflation Reduction Act didn't have that much in our category, a little bit, but there are other federal monies that are quite generous, and we've been tapping into those for some time.
Okay, great, thank you.
So Mr. Chair, I wanted to show you some data. There's two reports that come out every 2 years. I made the mistake of actually distributing in your packet one of these reports a couple of cycles ago, and former Representative Mary Murphy gave me a good scowl for putting so much paper in the folders, and so I haven't done it since. But one of the reports is the draft impaired waters list. Every 2 years, the US EPA requires states to submit an impaired waters list of waters that do not meet water quality standards. Our list is rather big, but I want to add some qualifications to that. Minnesota has the resources to look for more contaminants in more places, often with more protective standards than other states. So our list is much bigger than other states. It doesn't mean we're more polluted, it just means we're looking. In addition, states have flexibility on how they go about looking for things. So Wisconsin doesn't test for bacteria in streams, for example, and we do. So we have several hundred more impairments for bacteria. As such, that list is not always a good measure of progress. It is a good diagnostic tool that helps us know where to target money in the future. That is why we do the monitoring. All of the science that we do to figure out what the impairments are is only about 15% of the fund, and that helps us figure out how to spend the rest of the 85% as wisely as possible. I do want to mention to get off the impaired waters list. Oh, yes, Mr. Chair, hold on.
I have a question from, Representative Backer, I thought you had a question. You don't?
No, I do. Either of us. So just a point, and I appreciate the work that you do, but it was talked about earlier about nitrates. You know, saying that the neighbor next door is the only cause of it, we also have to acknowledge that nitrates have been occurring long before I was on the face of the earth, okay? So I just caution folks to say agriculture the only way, because one of the things that we do not hear is we don't hear the rest of the story, and I'm not being Paul Harvey right now, but we don't hear the rest of the story in regards with we don't see the constituents I work with and the people I spoke with wasting nitrates. That's just like throwing money down the hole. None of us would take our wallets out and throw money up in the air or burn it. Our ag producers are good stewards. They are. They really are. I know there's people who would disagree with me, and please come out to my district, and I will let you make that decision. But they're not wasting nitrates, because if you waste nitrates, it is wasting a lot of money. So I just cautious when we talked about those type of scenarios and just reference one aspect of that, because there are other ways of controlling nitrates, and the ag industry has done very well just in the last 5 years cutting back on the use of nitrates. We also have to talk about what people are doing good instead of just what we're concerned about, and be cautious. I've been caught in that cycle too, so instead of just focusing on one aspect. I share that just to have a broader picture of that, because clean water is important. You know, we have different debates on how that money should be used for clean water, and so forth, and we'll have that conversation later. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the indulgence.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had the pleasure of seeing Representative Backer out in Grant County a couple months ago at that massive flood impoundment and water quality project in Grant County. It's one of the most massive holes in the ground I've seen, other than up in Chisholm when I've seen a mine.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Backer. Yeah, Representative Backer.
Yeah, you can call me Fred Flintstone if you want, Mr. Chair. No. that's a lot better than whatever the people have called me. But that's right. Thank you for reminding me. And that's different things that we're doing out there to have clean water, and the ag producers and the landowners adjacent are working diligently to not just catch water, but to make it cleaner. So thank you for bringing that back out. And it was a nice day that day.
It was a beautiful day, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gardner.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I wasn't totally trying to suck up to the members.
Your point well taken.
I did want to finish on the impaired waters list by mentioning that many of the waters that are coming off the impaired waters list in large numbers are in the metro. The metro did have a head start. There were more requirements for planning and monitoring for metro watershed districts, which have levying authority before the Clean Water Fund. And so in the 10 to 20 years that it takes for some of these bodies of water to get off the list, some of the ones that started first are now coming off. So we're going to see those numbers accelerate. We do have waters that are coming off in greater Minnesota, but certainly a higher concentration have been in the metro. And here again, I am sucking up, Mr. Chair, of Coleman Lake and Maplewood in your neck of the woods, Stillwater with Lily Lake. The phosphorus impairment came off, although the amoeba thing there is still a problem. And then the Maple Grove is a fish lake coming off. Mr. Chair, I did want to share some good news, and Representative Backer will like some of the other good news I have in a minute. The Clean Water Fund is used for the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, which is more generously funded from the bonding bill, but it actually started out with the Clean Water Fund. And in the green here, you can see what happened with wastewater treatment plants that have been impacted by that PSIG program since the inception of the Clean Water Fund, and we've seen phosphorus loads drop at those clean water funded facilities. We do make about $16 to $18 million available to the PFA to do that. You can see the phosphorus load, the median load dropped, if you look at those dotted lines, in half since the Clean Water Fund went into effect. We have some good news on lake clarity. More lakes are clearer than ones that are less clear by a factor of about 3 to 1. We also have lakes that are seeing no change, which is often very good because they're not getting worse despite development pressures and the like. So we look at trends instead of just the impaired waters list. Mr. Chair, we want to know if we're going in the right direction. So generally speaking, in the last few decades, we have been. Do have some bad news. One of the contaminants that is rising, particularly here in the metro, is chloride. This comes from mostly road salt, but it also has other sources like inefficient water softeners. We have been addressing some of those with grants, but this is why we have a smart salting program, Mr. Chair. You've probably seen people with their little spoons talking about using less salt, same idea. We actually have helped snow removal contractors and public works departments save money. At the same time, they're reducing the amount of salt and using just enough to be able to do the job. But this is going to be an issue long into the future because you can't just really get rid of chloride in a local lake. Once it's in there, it's not really effective to do something. So prevention is the key. We have some good news and bad news here in our larger rivers. Total phosphorus loads and total suspended solids, dirt essentially, have been going down for the most part. Some of that is due to wastewater treatment. Some of that is due to structural practices on the land. But nitrate levels have been going up over the last 20 years. So now, the fun part, Mr. Chair, agriculture and water quality, which you asked me to address. We do spend a significant amount of money in the Clean Water Fund on water quality from agriculture. And to answer the general question, are we improving? I would say generally, yes, where we spend money. But we still have an issue of scale and speed that we would like to increase, and there's several challenges about that. But I wanted to mention a couple of things that we do to improve water quality in farm country. One is that we do have the ability to spend money according to the statute that we voted for, Mr. Chair, back in 2009 that allows for money for enhanced compliance and enforcement. We do this thing through SSTS. We allow counties more money to inspect septic systems, so the compliance rate is higher. The state has, 10 years ago or so, enacted the buffer law. Some dollars from the Clean Water Fund have been used to help farmers figure out how to comply with the law. We don't use money for enforcement on the buffers. That's through a different bill. We've also worked on the groundwater protection rule, which I'll mention in a minute. We've also paid to take some land out of production that's would be protective of groundwater in particular. So 23,000 and change acres have been put into easements since the inception of the Clean Water Fund. We spend a lot on technical assistance to show people the desired thing that we'd like to see. So during the growing season, it's great opportunity to go to field days to see how farmers have done things well. There is definitely some interesting cultural phenomena, I would say, as a city dweller. We all worry about what our peers say, and every farmer I've ever heard say they've done something successfully has said, we wanted to take a risk in doing something different, but we didn't want to be talked about at the coffee shop by our neighbors, and so we planted cover crops behind the barn so no one could see until we knew it would work. Or sometimes the oldest generation would say, what would the neighbors think if we did something different? So there are some forces at work that aren't necessarily based on data. It's based on local culture, but we help to break that down. We do support both state and local government employees to work with farmers to listen to them, to find out what their needs are for using their land and find a tailored solution that would improve water quality. So I used to think the phrase one size doesn't fit all was kind of a dodge, and I've discovered that it's absolutely true. No field, no parcel is exactly the same, and no landowner is the same. We also provide low-interest loans for equipment, as I mentioned before. We fund a lot of structural practices. This can be adding water quality elements to a drainage improvement project. It could be a WASCOB, a water and sediment control basin, that is a berm that is perpendicular to the flow of water that helps slow water down so that we avoid erosion and the flow of phosphorus into our surface waters. We promote a lot of vegetative cover, which is actually the most effective tool for reducing nitrates in surface water. So you see a cover crop here on the right designed to do that. But generally speaking, where we spend that money, trends improve. Sometimes it's hard to see where the trend is by the way we measure. So it's expensive to do an edge of field monitoring to see how one field is doing. We tend to monitor at a stream or lake or watershed level. And so we look at the accumulation of factors over several years, and we have to have several years as a trend. But generally, where we have that high touch technical assistance with farmers, people tend to change. This is one of my favorite testimonials for what works. This is a farmer in Grand County, and this family employed technical assistance provided by the Clean Water Fund and others, and they discovered that not only did they have better yields during dry years, which we've had recently, they actually had more infiltration of their soil, more porosity, greater organic content because of soil health practices like no-till and cover crops, and they're saving money by making fewer passes with their tractor. So this is an example where everybody wins. The farmer makes more money, has lower risk from adverse weather events, and improves water quality at the same time. But Mr. Chair, this is the kind of thing that people don't go back on. Once they do it, they don't go back. But it's a very labor-intensive, high-touch interaction between people who have skills, talking to the landowner who has a legacy of working that land. And when it works, the light bulb goes off and everything falls into place and you get these stories. But we still have a long way to go, Mr. Chair. This person is certified by the Ag Water Quality Certification Program, fully funded by the Clean Water Fund, and we now have more than 1 million acres. It's about 5% of cropland acres in Minnesota that are certified, and the number keeps going up every week. I'm sorry, was there a question?
So, Mr. Gardner, just like this picture here, which is one like family or whatever farm group, so there's 1,450 farms around the state that you're working with?
But Mr. Chair, it's far more than that. These are just the farmers that agreed to have a whole farm assessment, which is actually a big deal to have an assessor look at all components of a farm's operation. And you have to exceed the standard in all categories. I think there are 10 points you get. You can't just do one thing. And so you only get certification if you do all 10. To be sure, there are many more farmers than this that are doing lots of good things, just maybe not in all 10 categories. So the agricultural census just came out, and so we're parsing through that data to figure out what's worked. And we know, for example, that cover crops have increased by 31% over 5 years, and that's good. It's still small, though. But this farmer is one of the ones that did it. And so we're trying to figure out, is there just correlation, or did this spending get people to do it, and how far? So
I was looking at some of the I think some of the people that have done these literature on it, and is the new representative that took over for Drazkowski, is it Perry, does he have a certi- huh
I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Don't you have a certified farm or
yeah,
I didn't realize you were here. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Paul Anderson in Pope County is also a certified farmer. Actually, Representative Jacob farms the land that my wife's great-great-grandfather farmed. We just met yesterday, and we're related.
I don't know if you're willing, Mr. Representative Jacob. Would you be willing to come up and just tell us about the program?
Sure.
And what it means to an individual farmer, if that's all right. Just kind of seems too good an opportunity to pass on.
Come on down.
Representative Jacob, welcome to the Legacy Committee.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So I guess it was about 12 years ago, I think Mr. Brad Redland over there came down to Whitewater Township with this proposal of a pilot program for the ag water quality certification. And I'm a, you know, I'm a conservative guy. I was concerned about potential regulations there. And but once we went through the process of getting that pilot program going, could see the benefits in it. And so then certainly I signed up then early on. I think I was the sixth farm in the state to become ag water quality certified. The certification is good for 10 years. And so I'm up for that already. been involved in it for 10 years. So then I've recently brought a bill forward, just dropped night before last, to tie a tax credit to farmers that have become ag water quality certified. So it's clearly, the benefits are much more than just nitrates, right? So any potential pesticide, there's talk about fish kills, things of that nature. So any potential runoff that could come off of agricultural property, you know, this would be a solution to that. So we want to do what we can to expand the program.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions for? Yeah, thank you very much. It wasn't planned, but glad to hear a personal story. And mm-hmm. I had read about it in one of the brochures and or online, I think, and it stood out. But well, thank you very much.
Yeah. All right.
And Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gardner.
Oh, it left me for a minute.
Well, Mr. Chair, the Department of Ag also does an audit after 3 years, I think it is, to see that those practices are still being followed and they can check in. So that this isn't a one-off and then someone just turns around and plows everything up again. So, and the number of people that have actually had to drop out of the program is so small, it usually happens when there's a sale of land or things changing hands, so.
We have a question from Chair Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, can you, I do see that this is a great program, and I think we definitely want more farmers to participate. Are there like specific barriers as to why more farmers have not participated on this program?
Or could
have? Mr. Chair and Chair Vang, Mr. Ridland probably could give you more answers because I know they've done surveys. You know, not every farmer wants to go through the whole process. They might want to improve just in a particular area. And we certainly have tools for them, but I'm afraid I might punt to Mr. Redland on the data because they've actually done surveys. I said his name twice and he came, it worked. So.
Thank you, Representative Jacobs, for coming forward. Please introduce yourself and thank you for coming up. And did you hear Chair Vang's question or would you like to repeat it?
No, I believe I have the question. Thank you, Chair. My name is Brad Jordahl Redland, Program Manager, Minnesota Department of Ag for the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program and the Soil Health Financial Assistance Program as well. In terms of the challenges we face or the growers face, frankly, in becoming certified is that, number one, it's entirely voluntary and it's not a race. There's a lot of choices that come into obtaining certification, everything from generational transition, you know, is the next generation going to want to be, how many more years am I farming? And, you know, as just one very kind of specific example, but it could be any number of things. One of the challenges that I think clean water funds are also tackling in this area is when you're talking about making conservation changes, soil health changes on your farm, it's about things like cover crop seed, but it's also things like cover crop cedar. So equipment is my point I'm driving at here. Equipment is incredibly expensive, and if you're making changes from full width tillage to a strip till machine, you know, you buy a new strip till machine, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. So these are major consequences that can occur in the process of certification. These are gonna be grower choices. No one's forcing anyone to get a $200,000 piece of equipment. But those are the type of choices that do come up in the process of certification and addressing the risks that are identified on their farming operation in a way that will best serve them and ultimately best serve their bottom line. Because we do like to point out, it's been mentioned before, but through the study of the ag-centric and Minnesota State Colleges, for the last 4 years running, the certified farms have averaged $25,000 higher profit than those farms in their database that aren't certified. So it does have those advantages across the board, as Mr. Gardner had already referenced.
Thank you, Mr. Ellman. Chair Vang? Okay. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, I wanted to mention that, or maybe
Mr.
Redland do it, about nitrate reductions from certified farms, too.
Oh, Mr. Redland.
Yes, another really challenging thing to get your arms around, because the every day's weather is going to change your nitrate experience and your nitrogen behavior. So that's very difficult to tell. But through the certification program and the practices that we've implemented, we've documented through the research of those practices that we're achieving up to 49% reduction in nitrate loss on certified farms. So that is what we're for. That's why we're the service we're trying to provide our growers. So we're glad to see that it's bearing out.
Repeat that. That's 49%
up reduction. To 49% okay. Effectiveness in the practices implemented. Yep.
Stick around for a millisecond. I think we have one more question.
Sure.
Oh, I guess not. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Redland.
I'm just wrapping up with two more slides, Mr. Chair, and then you can.
We have a question for you, though, so I guess it's later on as well. So go ahead, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One area where we do use the Clean Water Fund for enhanced compliance is with the groundwater protection rule. This rule preceded my time in the council, but it went into effect in 2019. There are roughly two dozen communities that have elevated nitrate, and that triggers a variety of voluntary actions at first, and then eventually after several actions are taken, including a plan to figure out what would be needed to reduce nitrate in those wells on nearby land, the clock ticks for a few years, and then if things don't improve, then regulation can kick in. That's sort of the short version. To date, the three plans have been finished for Verndale, Hastings, and it'll come to me, Adrian, I think. And then those are actually very interesting things to look at, Mr. Chair, because computer modeling can actually determine within reason what parcels of land are the likely contributors to of nitrate to a public water supply well. And then we can calculate different combinations of practices that over the whole area, not just a one-size-fits-all approach, would solve the problem. So that's very empowering, but it is slow work, and we probably could use some more resources to be able to carry that out further. Finally, Mr. Cure, there are some challenges here that are outside of our control. The Ag Census just showed us last week that almost half of cropland acres in Minnesota are rented. It's harder to get someone to make a decision about making big change if the landowner is in St. Paul or California or somewhere else. Sometimes that non-operating landowner lives in the house on the farm. Sometimes they live in town. Sometimes they live somewhere else. And then the renter rents, and there's sometimes a handshake deal for what to do. There are tools we do have to let landowners know what they could ask for from renters to do better. There are a handful of acres that are certified that are rented. But it's just harder, and it's more labor-intensive. And we would need to have somebody actually reach out to those landowners. Sometimes the renter wants to do better, and the landowner's not interested. Sometimes the landowner wants to do better, and the renter's not interested. So it just takes longer to get people together. Second, commodity markets ebb and flow. We're watching what happens with things like biofuel markets and whether people would keep land in production for certain things, and that can have an impact. We just noticed in the Ag Census data that there's been a drop by more than a million acres of land that's in conservation programs. I assume, but I don't know for sure, that may be due to lower rates for the CRP program, because a lot of people took temporary easements out. Don't know for certain, but we've got a million acres certified in the water quality program, but another million acres went out of conservation because of underlying economic conditions and CRP rates. So. The average age of a farmer is also 57. I'm almost 57, and I do not want to do things that are risky or new, Mr. Chair. That is just normal, and I may there's a lot of land changing hands from one generation to the next, so I can understand why Mr. Redland would acknowledge that people aren't sure what the next generation is going to do. So we have a transition period with a lot of land in Minnesota, and it's also an opportunity to reach out to them to let them know of the opportunities to improve water quality. So
Mr. Chair, I'll leave it there and let the pylon begin.
Pylon. Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Director, for coming in and your presentation today. I have a couple of things. I'll just start with, here again, a little bit of a peek behind the curtain. The Clean Water Council makes recommendations, and then the legislature has an opportunity to weigh in. That's the process. And from time to time, the Clean Water Council's recommendations might change a little bit coming through that process. And there again, that's fine. That's the process. But from time to time, there have been dollars that have been left on the bottom line, and I have been one of those saying, let's make a recommendation, as opposed to just leaving those dollars sitting. And, you know, like I said, if legislators want to make an adjustment, that's within their purview, technically. But when money is just left unrecommended, that almost feels, and we don't talk about motive here in the legislature, but it feels a little strange. And there even have been legislators that have gone so far as to write letters suggesting that maybe we leave money on the bottom line. And people may have feelings about that. I have my own feelings. I was hoping that maybe the director could just talk a little bit about what the Clean Water Council has done to make a recommendation potentially for dollars that were not allocated in this cycle. And I believe that a recommendation was made, but I don't know that we discussed that today. And if I have the wrong information, the director could clarify and the public could be enlightened.
Or,
Mr. Gardner, I think they kind of went through their proposal of, like, in the beginning of the recommendations for this, for the surplus. But go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, we have been taken to task occasionally by members of both parties for either recommending or not recommending money, and that's fine. That's just how it goes. It was a good idea to, when there is a surplus, to make recommendations for how to use it. Usually the surplus is like $1 million, and it's not worth the paperwork sometimes. But we've had, this time it's 18 million, I think, in the last biennium is 30 some. And the council felt it was important not to just leave that sitting and to make a recommendation. And we are advisory, so if the legislature wants to do something different, they can. But we did come up with a better process, Representative Heisman, and I think you were probably responsible for goading us in that direction. So we charted out time after the forecast to figure out what to do in December and ask agencies what their needs might be. And council also expressed some of their own preferences, and it worked out. So,
Representative Heitzman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the recommendations today that were discussed, I think it's super important that we just highlight those and talk about that a little bit. As you know, previously we've seen a little bit of a different process, and I just thank you for the opportunity to mention that. And I thank the Clean Water Council for moving forward with, I think, which is a better process, at least looking at the needs around the state and having so many of those things front and center at the Clean Water Council. I think they're in a great position to make a recommendation. So we'll see what the next forecast does and if there is a continuation of maybe what we hope could be additional monies. We'll see, but just wanted to highlight that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, your little comment about $1 million not worth doing, I have a spot that I'd like to see it go to, and and that is the low-income SST grants. And I think that directly benefits clean water. You can't get there fast enough. When we're getting these old systems and everything, I'm glad to see that you included it, but if you have extra, I would love to see it go there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, just to wrap up.
Mr. Gardner.
If you do have more in the February forecast, we do have another list of some things that we could add to. And if you, for whatever reason, constitutional or otherwise, choose not to focus on well mitigation, we have some recommendations for that too. So we're ready to go with Plan B.
Thank you. Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to the director, kind of along that same point of your remarks. So I'm just curious, were there other consideration outside of what you have here for this round of supplemental funding, knowing that the majority of this, I think two of them are new, that are not supplementing projects that were funded last year. So did you consider other projects to your point that you just made?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair and Chair Lee, the only completely new program is the well response to southeastern Minnesota. Everything else is already in the current fiscal 24-25 appropriation. We also have a strategic plan that gives us an overarching idea of what we want to accomplish, and so that impacted some of their requests as well. And we had to cut a few things. We had more requests than we could meet.
Chair
Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Gardner, I guess, let me rephrase this. You said that, you know, if we were to have a forecast with more funding, you have other projects that's in line. And so what was the consideration in putting in more money for these projects, and why didn't you consider those projects that you have down the pipeline?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Chair Lee. So, for example, at the MPCA, we considered putting more money into chloride reduction grants to help replace old water softeners at certain cities where they have a chloride permit that has an issue. But we saw things like the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative where we actually could get some matching funds from the federal government. So $1 million there actually would mean more than $1 million overall, which we could not do with the chloride grants. That would be an example. There was a Bowser program for easements, the same thing, where we think we can get some federal matching funds.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a comment and statement then, just, you know, looking at these proposals, you know, for example, the drinking water contaminants of emergent concern, we put in significant dollars in there and then we're re-upping that. And so that's why I'm asking why we didn't, or why didn't the council consider other projects too, because we did put significant dollars into these projects if there are additional projects down the pipeline. And then, Mr. Chair, maybe a request to the agencies, not for right now, but I think a follow-up will be good to know of the appropriations that we did put in last year, how have they implemented those dollars from 2024, and give us an update, you know, to kind of justify why we should put in additional dollars into their requests. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, now, I have to be honest, that was a little bit of my hope, too, is to kind of hear a little bit more of, you know, looking at what we've been doing too, and how it's spent. And I know Chair Hansen had a concern that some of the thing that we put in a couple of years ago is, I'm not sure it's ever been done. So I don't know if there's.
This is the plastics.
Yes.
Oh, I can do that. Yeah.
So, but so very good questions by Chair Lee, and go ahead if you have a comment.
Oh, sure. Mr. Chair, gosh, I mean, we could be here a week pouring over through metrics for different things. First, on the microplastics, which Representative Hansen is interested in, I updated him recently on that. So
okay, good.
There was an appropriation in a previous bill to test for microplastics through our regular monitoring program, and that actually is, the sampling is almost done. There's just a few drinking water plants to look at. The surface water sampling was done last year, and I actually went to the first well water testing site in Lake Elmo where they did it and sat there for 2 hours while the hose goes through. There had to be some custom fabricated equipment for that. The USGS has done the surface water monitoring for microplastics, and they have to actually separate plastics from the sediment. That's taking a long time. But we would have I think it'll be a one-of-a-kind study result, if not 2024 and 2025, that will do something that other people haven't done, which is look at raw and finished drinking water and the presence of microplastics, the presence of microplastics in surface waters, as well as groundwater, and figure out what it means and do more characterization. It's one thing to just find it. It's another to figure out where it might be coming from and what its source is. So that will be, dare I say, nation leading. In terms of metrics, Mr. Chair, so for every grant that we do through Bowser, through the watershed-based planning, which is that's $79 million in the current biennium, each grant that we make for that has an outcome associated with it. So certain pounds of phosphorus removed from a particular project, nitrates reduced, total suspended solids avoided, and the like. I would say the trouble I have sometimes is figuring out a way to have that all on a dashboard so that it can be in a form that makes sense to you. There is a tracking tool that several local governments are trying out to be able to show the progress towards goals, so they can tell you whether they're checking off all the boxes and everything. So I would call that an IT issue where it's kind of clunky. Mm-hmm. There are some good questions being raised at the Clean Water Council about things that we know are good and based on good science, but we don't necessarily point to a particular outcome. So the low interest loans for equipment, for example, it's easy if someone replaces the septic system, you're either compliant or you're not. But we want to see how many acres are being affected by a no-till drill, for example, so that we can put that in our calculus to figure out how we're doing. We have multiple measures. We have 100 pages of different measures in our performance report, which are mind-numbing, quite frankly, if you look at them as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I plucked half a dozen of the key charts out there to show some of the main ideas. I found that agencies are very responsive if we know what the question is on something specific. And so I can just keep working with you, Mr. Chair, to see what specific things we can answer for you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gardner. I just happened to be up the avenue the other day. I was at, I'm sure it was one of your clean water projects right outside the Goodwill on University of all places, and it had a little rain garden there off the road. And I know you do a lot of things in the metro. A lot of what we talked about is in greater Minnesota, but there's a lot of, need in the metro as well that needs to, so I hope you look at that with your supplemental. And, it's hard for our money to be spent on, Lessard Sam's projects, for example, which has a big number of, in the metro, but a lot of projects could be done with habitat and cleaning up waters of the metro to make sure that they're swimmable and fishable and drinkable. And I think that's really important, equity issue and quality of life for the state. And I know that you said some of the projects like that are going to be funded are like on the Rush Creek, that'll help feed the Minneapolis water. And I get that, and a lot of the investments that are done through Lessard also helps clean up water, but not only habitat but helps up clean up things. But
sure.
Are you making an effort to in the metro beyond rain gardens? Are you working on the lakes themselves and the rivers that run through our major cities and trying to make sure that people can get on, clean water and get out there and swim in them?
Sure. Mr. Chair, our metro conservation districts and watershed districts are very adept at applying for and getting grants mostly from Bowser for water quality projects through the Clean Water Fund. They often have the advantage of having their own sources of funding too through levying authority. And the watershed districts in greater Minnesota have less of a tax base, and my local watershed district has $1 million to give away for residents to use and businesses for projects. So there are chunks of change there. We did do a metro field tour of projects this last September, which was just great. We went from Afton to Forest Lake to Edina, and then several projects in St. Paul, including the Allianz Field with their irrigation system. The Public Facilities Authority got $7 million from the fund for the Highland Bridge development, that massive redevelopment of the Ford site. It's amazing to see, but $7 million went for the water treatment system for the creek that feeds out of there. So all the crud from the streets and Summit Midway in Highland Park end up going through there. And so if you ever have a chance to go to Hidden Falls, the water from there is a lot cleaner than it was because of that project. So,
well, thank you very much. Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, specifically to that question, I was responsible at one point in my career for managing Lake Rebecca, which is western part of Hennepin County and Lake Rebecca Park Reserve. And we utilized funds from the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council to address some muskellunge problems in the lake. Muskellunge were dying, so we used some of their funding. In addition to clean water funds to clean up some of the incoming water, dealing with some manure, horse farm manure concerns. So I think both of the funds are used for specifically for lake improvement projects. And my time on the council has been that we look for all of those opportunities that we can to try to merge the funds as well as we can. And another prime example is down in the Lake Worthington, or excuse me, the Worthington area, dealing with their groundwater problems as well as providing pheasant habitat. So we protected some of the infiltration areas for their water supply as well as providing habitat for hunting and fishing. So I think there's a good synergy between the two funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today. I think we're basically there. And Mr. Gardner, thank you. Members, if you have questions, I'm certain that Mr. Gardner will be available at any time to meet with any of you. And I recommend that you send a lot of questions to Representative Heitzman, and that's on the council. Put them to work, and Representative Purcell as well in our body. But seeing no other business at this time, again, thank you for coming. And with that, we are adjourned.